The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 19. The Lie Detectives, in search of a playbook for winning elections in the disinformation age. Talking with author Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha joins us today from Philadelphia. Hi, Sasha, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. It's great to be with you.
Sasha Eisenberg teaches political science at the Department of Political Science at UCLA. He's an author and a journalist. His articles have appeared in Slate, Washington Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Boston, The Boston Globe, Monocle, and Bloomberg News. While at Bloomberg News, he covered the 2016 presidential election. He's the author of five books, including The Victory Lab. Sasha, let's start with the 2016 presidential election, one of the most consequential in recent American history. And while disinformation has been a feature of American elections for many years, the 2016 race stands out. Tell us about your experience covering the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, so I, in the fall of 2016, went down to San Antonio with my colleague at Businessweek, Josh Green, and we were there to report a story on Trump's digital operation. This was Trump's top digital director was sort of based in San Antonio and set up the operation there. And there's this moment that really stuck with me. We quoted in the story a top campaign official telling us that they had, quote, three major voter suppression efforts underway.
Uh-huh.
And then he started to get into how they were using Facebook dark posts to target information at these very discrete, narrow groups of voters, African-American, young African-American voters between a certain age, Latino voters in Miami-Dade County, young idealistic white liberals, and sort of described the targeting techniques that they were using to isolate these video messages with the goal of discouraging them from voting. And I'd written a lot about innovation in campaigns. It was part of the reason I was doing this story in the first place. I'd written a book a few years earlier about a largely happy story about all the sort of new data and experiments that were coming into politics and were largely being used to make political communication better, to get more efficient at registering and turning out voters, to give voters material and subjects that would be of more interest to them. This moment in San Antonio was the first time that I had encountered somebody who spoke the sort of language of high-tech, data-driven, modern campaigning to describe practices that you could describe as anti-democratic.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that struck me as like this big shift. You know, I had started writing about political innovation at a moment where we saw the internet as a catalyst for greater civic engagement.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a big part of the story we tell about Barack Obama's first campaign. I believe I sent my book, The Victory Lab, to the publisher the month that the Arab Spring was beginning. And part of the story we tell there is that, you know, one guy with a Twitter account could tell people to show up in Tahrir Square and didn't need to control the state radio or newspaper to organize a mass movement. And what I came to realize in 2016 and so frequently afterwards was the same way that social media had lowered the barriers to entry for sort of positive civic engagement. It also lowered the barriers for people who wanted to mislead, fuse voters, drive them away from the political process. And so that's become a sort of what has struck me over the last years as the most important sort of frontier of innovation in campaigns, which is what do you do in this new asymmetric environment where you're running against somebody who's not necessarily playing by the same rules or operating under the same constraints that you are.
One of the things that strikes me about that story is that this fellow that you interviewed from the Trump campaign, that he would be so blatant about it. I would have thought this was a guy that they wanted to keep hidden, closeted away in a back room and not let near the media. He seems to have been very cynical and taking it for granted that this kind of disinformation was fair game.
Yeah, I think there are probably two things that help explain that. One, the Trump campaign was filled in various forms with amateurs, people who had never done electoral politics, at this level in this way before. And a lot of times they just really didn't know what to say, what not to say, or the sort of polite language for things that they were doing. And in this case, I think somebody was more inadvertently candid than they might have been with a little more practice. The other part of it, which I think is the more enduring, now Trump is surrounded by professional campaign people and they have had enough experience about what to say. But the more important shift, and I think this is evident in sort of like MAGA-style politics online particularly, is that Trump sends a signal to his supporters and to his staff and consultants that he is willing to play by a different set of rules or no rules at all. And through his actions, he does all sorts of things that sort of violate existing norms, not just the norms of office and governance, but existing norms of campaign practice. You know, I mean, for example, campaigns are traditionally this command and control enterprise. You're running for office, you invest a lot of money in research to determine what you say, policy research, issue research, opposition research, opinion research, and you formulate, like, down to the word what you want to say on any given topic and decide when you want to be talking about what. And that's how basically every campaign running for board of supervisors up to president has always tried to operate, at least. Trump, as we see on social media, he will take a supporter's homemade content and amplify it, spread it to all of his followers, regardless of whether that is not just whether or not it's true, but whether it even aligns with what, you know, he wants to be talking about. So he has sort of institutionalized a kind of chaotic approach to political communication that I think his whole movement has internalized. And I think it's one reason that he is such a force online, is that he is compelling and unpredictable, but also he entrusts people to sort of communicate on his behalf without being handcuffed the way that a traditional campaign would do to their employees or supporters.
Sounds very much seat of the pants. But let's move on to the lie detectives. What is it about disinformation that should worry all of us, regardless of our beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the lack of a common, any sort of common, shared, agreed upon set of facts, you know, I focus on politics, but I think it's a society more widely, makes it really difficult to sustain a healthy democracy. Most of what I write in the book is from the perspective of candidates. And yes, I think you're right, Jim, to suggest that, look, sometimes disinformation will help the candidates you like, and sometimes it'll hurt the candidates you like, and maybe it won't actually have an impact on the election results. But the consensus that obviously not everybody agrees on every policy, but generally we've had a broadly accepted set of facts about the state of the economy, about whether vaccines work, about whether crime is going up or down, and that's the foundation on which governments are able to sort of set policy and communicate with the governed. And I think it's probably the most egregious thing right now is lack of confidence in election results. I mean, you really cannot run a government if a significant portion of the electorate is sort of under the sway of conspiracy theories that sort of reject basic truths.
Who is Gior Craig, and what made her so special among the political consultants in Washington? You talk about her quite a bit in your book.
Yeah, so this woman, Gior Craig, is sort of the main character of my book. And the book starts in the aftermath of that 2016 period. And, you know, just about everybody in politics is shocked by Trump's victory. And Democrats, those on the American left, are sort of casting about for explanations. And one line of inquiry focuses on all these things that were going on online over the course of the 2016 election that didn't fully get understood at the time, but in retrospect seemed to loom large. And so you have senior people at the Democratic National Committee, at the AFL-CIO, major donors like Reid Hoffman, are all asking these questions of, like, what are bots? What are trolls? Like, there's just a whole new, you know, people who've been running campaigns for decades are forced to realize that all the communications vectors that they had grown up with were no longer the only ones that mattered for politics. They start asking, who should we be talking to about this stuff? And pretty soon, everybody finds their way back to this woman, Gior Craig. She's 25 years old. She grew up in Illinois. She was this Model UN nerd who ends up after college working for a political consulting firm in Washington called Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. It's a polling firm, but it happens almost by circumstance to have developed this large international campaign consulting practice that Sam Greenberg, the main partner, was Tony Blair's pollster, Nelson Mandela's pollster. So they've ended up doing campaigns on basically every continent. And so Jory Craig comes out of college and all of a sudden is getting sent around the world to work on campaigns. The first thing is she goes to Moldova to help a party leader get set up on Facebook, right? Uh-huh. And then she goes to Gabon and the Philippines and Panama. And at this moment in 2017, when people in democratic politics are trying to understand this new world, she's the closest thing that there is to somebody with practical experience, in part because what seemed novel to us in 2016, things like foreign interference in our elections, the increased role of partisan and ideological media, the sort of power of rumor to drive opinion, those are new, or at least recent. We had some of these in the 19th century, but those were a shock to our system in 2016. Those are parts of the political process, or permanent endemic parts of how politics is waged across the world. Jory Craig was able to sort of bring a wealth of experience. She'd worked in Eastern Europe where, like, yeah, Russian interference is just letting people sort of price into their campaign strategies. She had worked in parts of the world where rumor is, it's just understood that rumors are going to drive opinions in the absence of TV advertising. And so she just had a mindset that made her incredibly useful. And she becomes basically the first full-time counter-disinformation operative in American politics, and has done more in the 7 years since to shape how, more than anybody, to shape how campaigns sort of see the problem of disinformation and develop tools for, like, tracking, measuring, and responding to it.
Now, of course, that's the 2016 campaign. 2020, we had the Trump versus Biden election. And of course, this time around, 2024, not only do we have the prospect of disinformation, but now we have the prospect of disinformation based on artificial intelligence. And of course, sitting here in San Francisco with 15 of the largest 18 AI companies headquartered in San Francisco, what are your thoughts about the role that AI is going to play in disinformation with deep fakes, among other devices? What are your thoughts about disinformation for the 2024 presidential campaign? Is it going to be tougher? Is it going to be kind of a brave new world in the way that 2016 was a brave new world?
Yeah, and I think we're already seeing examples of deep fakes that were created presumably at low cost with little technical Look, people have made fake audio and fake video fake photos for quite a while now. But obviously the accessibility of these tools and the lack of sort of expertise that they require to make and disseminate, I think, is a big shift. And we've already seen examples. There was a robocall that went out to voters in New Hampshire, to Democrats around the primary, that had a plausible sounding AI version of Joe Biden telling Democrats not to vote on primary day because it was a waste of their vote. There was a photo that got promoted by Trump supporters, made by generative AI, that showed him, like, hanging out on a stoop with African-American supporters, not at all real. So I think we're starting to see this sort of just added to the arsenal. I would also be worried, I'd probably be more worried about audio than video, because I think there are just more cues in a visual deepfake to, you know, the six fingers and the light isn't really reflecting the right way type thing. To find frauds than there is in audio, where you can't really dwell on a particular part of the content the same way. I'd also worry about the way in which AI will facilitate creating lies at scale. So we should think about not just what happens if there's, you know, one deepfake of Joe Biden, but what if on one day 100 or 1,000 different sound bites of him saying different and conflicting things about Israel and Gaza come out. And there's just no ability to even focus on which one might be real. I suspect that the denial, you know, I think a lot about, there's this focus on the Georgia phone call that Trump made to the Secretary of State asking him to find votes. I suspect if that came out now, Trump would just say, oh, that's a deep fake, it's not me. Yes. And there would, you know, so I think it's, you know, it's not just that fake things will be understood to be true, but that now there's a way that people will discredit true things as fake. All that said, Jim, I think there's a tendency to get too obsessed with, like, the latest technological innovation and not think about and lose sight of the fact that the major disinformation episodes of the last 8 years, the sort of durable conspiracy theories that have shaped our politics, were not based on any sort of high-tech frauds. They were just based on words. You know, QAnon comes out of like the most simple, like text on a bulletin board, ASCII storytelling, basically. You know, Donald Trump's election denial conspiracies, you know, that was just a guy talking into a microphone most of the time. Persistence of coronavirus related conspiracies and vaccine skepticism. It wasn't like somebody used sophisticated tools to fake Pfizer drug trials to prove that they didn't work. People just told a convincing story. And in each of these instances, you had an audience that was primed to receive it and share it. And so I think if we focus too much on any one technology, we probably lose sight of the fact that the bigger issue is that we have a large share of the public that is primed to embrace certain lies or conspiracy theories. And I think that is a much deeper problem than we're going to solve with, you know, watermarking images or something to distinguish AI-generated ones from others.
Now, in your book, you talked about the 2022 presidential election in Brazil. And Brazil has gone a couple of steps further than we have here in the United States in terms of regulating these examples of disinformation. Are there lessons to be learned here in the United States from the way that Brazil is trying to combat disinformation from their presidential election 2 years ago, or it wouldn't work here?
So Brazil has probably the most powerful election regulator in the world. There's the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, which began as a court to oversee election law disputes, basically. And it has gradually, there was a big scandal after their 2018 election in which it was revealed that Bolsonaro supporters had used, largely through WhatsApp groups, had disseminated disinformation and committed campaign finance crimes in doing so. And basically over the last now 6 years, this court has cobbled together powers that it claims under the law, largely unaccountably, and has become incredibly powerful. They now, one judge on this court can have people jailed for publishing things online that basically he decides aren't true, has the ability to order tech companies, US-based tech companies, to remove a given piece of content. Facebook will do this, you know, within minutes for fear of massive fines if they don't. It's turned into basically a very productive content studio, creating original material, sort of pushing back on conspiracy theories. There are a number of reasons I don't think there's any version of the political will to do this here. We don't have a national, part of the reason I think that the election, the post-2020 election conspiracies here were able to take flight the way they did is we have this incredibly decentralized election system where every state runs their own thing, and then every county has some actually administers it, and sometimes you have town clerks who are decision makers, and in many other countries, you have one central authority, which is just a sort of different beast in how we run election law. The biggest difference, I think, between the U.S. and many other countries around the world is that the First Amendment is many other countries don't have a constitutional guarantee of freedom of expression or speech. And so there are things that this court in Brazil is able to do in the interest of public safety and confidence in the democratic systems that would clearly violate any court's understanding of First Amendment protections here. And the fact is that people in Brazil, this court ends up serving this really central role in the campaign because it's making decisions every day that are often more important than the decisions that like rival campaigns are making about what content's allowed to be published and what isn't. And the fact is that the broad sort of left and center of Brazilian politics has been so pleased with the outcomes that this court has helped deliver, basically stopping Bolsonaro from using some of these tactics to return to office and then aggressively punishing his supporters, including after they ransacked government buildings, sort of in their version of January 6th. Folks in the center and left of Brazilian politics are so happy with the outcomes that they are very unwilling to criticize the process. But quietly, people will acknowledge, yes, like liberal democracy in Brazil has been protected by an institution that is illiberal and anti-democratic And it has worked well from their perspective in the last few years, but you can imagine in the hands of somebody different, it would look very autocratic.
Well, and of course, we have to remember that Brazil, throughout the 20th century, the majority of the 20th century, they were governed by military dictatorships. So that tradition is still in the minds of Brazilian electors. You know, they don't want anyone interfering with their electoral process. So I guess they're willing to give up a certain amount of freedom of speech, if you will, to guarantee the integrity of the election process, because they, for the most part in the 20th century, they didn't have free and fair and open elections.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's this uniquely Brazilian history here. The other part of it I would throw in, and I think you're right, that the history of dictatorship and the pride that Brazilians take in the sort of return to multiracial democracy in the 80s is a big part of this. The other part of it is that Brazil was the first country on earth to use electronic voting machines, mm-hmm. starting around the year 2000. It's a source of immense national pride for them that they sort of took this step in sort of using technology to count the vote. It helped. You no longer had to carry like a sack of paper into the depths of the Amazon to get people to vote. You could bring this little computer down on rafts. It's a great story that Brazilians tell themselves. They have a museum of voting technology in Brasilia that shows this off. And so it is when Bolsonaro and his supporters started spreading their version of conspiracy theories about the voting machines. It hit in a different part of Brazilian identity. I mean, I'd say it would be like if you went around, you know, attacking the credibility of the NFL or Taylor Swift in our country, except we've seen that happen now. So I don't know what is sacred here. But in Brazil, there's still a sense of sacredness, yes, about voting processes that, mm-hmm. that we don't have. And I think that's one more reason that there's a sort of willingness to stand up a government agency to protect the integrity of that process.
In your book, you talk about the counter-disinformation operatives really struggling, particularly in Latino and Asian American communities, which have been targeted by disinformation. What are the unique challenges that they face there? And of course, you live in Los Angeles. Of course, you and I both know that both the Latino community and the Asian American community here in California is a very significant part of the 22 million registered voters in California. And if we have, you know, those two communities that are targets of this disinformation generally in campaigns, what steps can counter disinformation operatives take to keep those communities and all communities engaged and not have them lose faith in the system because of disinformation?
Yeah, so I think a lot of our focus for those of us in the media, people who are trying to get a handle on this, has been on Facebook because it is sort of so central to all the questions about politics and social media, at least since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and Twitter and X because, frankly, that's where journalists are, and that's where the political class goes. But people who are running campaigns are increasingly focused on messaging apps, WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, that unlike Facebook and Twitter, offer no visibility to outsiders. Mm-hmm. So we can get some sense of what's being posted and what's moving on the big social media platforms. You can't, in the messaging apps, if you're not in a group, you don't know what's going on there.
Right.
And they're by invitation only, and they are increasingly central to communication in non-English-speaking communities in the United States. I read about the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. This is the House Democrats' campaign arm. And something that they've started doing over the last 4 or 5 years is, you know, when they send a field organizer to a new district, you know, especially like in Orange County, California, or in South Florida, but they do this all over the country. You know, the old set of tasks would be, okay, you know, show up in your community, go find a storefront that we can rent, buy some clipboards, order in pizza, bring in the volunteers, and teach them how to knock on doors.
You forgot the ironing boards.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, whatever cheap furniture you can get. And now the first task is go meet people in the community and ask to get invited to all of the closed groups, because these have become sort of hybrids of text chains and broadcast platforms. And there are closed WhatsApp groups that are basically taking the place of talk radio in some communities, mm-hmm. where you have a central figure who's ascending radio. People are going to it to get their news. And you sometimes have tens of thousands of people in there. And the role of these field organizers is to get access in the same way that an intelligence agent might, or an ethnographer, to sort of break into the information networks in these communities so that they can track what's being said and sort of funnel it up to people in Washington.
Well, we actually saw that here in San Francisco, actually 2 years ago. We had two recall elections here. One was for district attorney, and that was a successful recall. And then the second recall election was for three members of the Board of Education, I should say. And that was also successful. And the closed WhatsApp and communication links that you mentioned, they were very instrumental in informing voters about the issues in both of those elections. At this point, is it even possible in 2024, with all that we've talked about, is it possible to build trust with voters this year? I mean, even if Donald Trump wanted to build trust with voters, is it in his DNA? And how does President Biden sort of deal with this asymmetric approach to campaign messaging that will be coming from the Trump campaign, is coming from the Trump campaign?
Yeah, so I read about this big research project that the Biden campaign embarked on in 2020, and I think it still sort of demonstrates their mentality about all this. Their approach, and the sort of, I write about Rob Flaherty, who was the digital director of the campaign in 2020, became the digital director of the White House, is now a deputy campaign manager with a lot of authority on the re-election race. And his sense was that the job of the campaign was just to focus on disinformation that was going to get in front of the voters that they cared about. The fact is, people are lying about politicians all day on the internet. A lot of it, from Biden's perspective, is circulating. A lot of the anti-Biden stuff is circulating among Trump supporters, mm-hmm. who create it to amuse themselves or to get Trump's attention or whatever it is. But it's not getting in front of persuadable voters, or it's not demotivating Biden's donors. And that's really no worry for Biden's campaign. And so Flaherty's view was that the campaign had to be able to identify the disinformation that was market moving, in his words, and just focus on that. And so they did this big research project, and they surveyed persuadable voters, assembled a list of viral narratives, storylines that were circulating online, and they asked voters, have you heard of this? Do you believe it? And could it affect your support for Biden versus Trump? And they mapped this on a grid, and on one axis was the reach. How many people had heard it and had heard it? And then on the other axis was it likely to affect people's vote choice? And what they found was that the stuff related to Hunter Biden and alleged corruption, a lot of persuadable voters were familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But they said it actually wasn't likely to affect their vote choice, and focus groups helped reveal why. Mm. Voters just didn't see Biden as motivated by personal financial gain. But the stuff, what Trump called Sleepy Joe, which we hear about a lot more now, Biden's age and the suggestion that he's mentally diminished, mm-hmm. that was potentially damaging the campaign. Mm. People said it might affect their vote choice, but the focus groups revealed what it was. Like, voters were not actually worried about Biden's physical fitness. They saw him as a fundamentally weak political figure. I think this mm-hmm. probably has to do a lot with him having been vice president, him sort of winning the nomination without ever really being the main character of that campaign. And voters were worried that, as I quote one of the pollsters, he would not be the author of his presidency. And that just manifests itself mm-hmm. in saying that they were worried about the age question. And so the campaign, communications advisors in the campaign had been doing stuff like scheduling photo ops for him to ride a bicycle on camera, or like having him run up the stairs of his plane. And this research project suggested that was like entirely misguided. Voters were not worried that like Biden wasn't going to get his steps in on a given day. they were worried that they didn't know what he believed and that he would end up be controlled around by other people in the White House. And so their response ended up being to buy ads against search results so that when somebody went on Google and typed in Biden senile or something like that, they would end up being shown a 15-second video of Biden speaking to camera, seemingly unedited, about like his economic policy, seemingly really banal stuff that had nothing to do with his age. But the campaign's view was that they were not addressing the individual piece of disinformation. They were trying to get at the underlying concerns of voters and make them less receptive to the disinformation. The way they described this was thinking of this not as a supply side problem, which has generally been the approach, but think of it as a demand side problem. Why are voters willing to receive this? And let's attack that instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sasha, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts, number one? And number two, what role will you be playing in covering the 2024 election?
So, you know, my closing thoughts are, I think things look pretty bleak this year. As you mentioned, there are sort of new technologies that complicate this. All of the sort of major social media companies in some form or another are pulled back from the sort of commitments that they made to moderate content. Some of them talking about pulling back from being a space for political communication altogether. And so I think this election year stands to be pretty scary from the perspective of disinformation. I also would caution that, you know, I don't think that this is like a unavoidable declension narrative forever. And some of this stands to be cyclical. I think that there are things which could probably draw tech companies back into wanting to be seen as aggressively policing content on their platforms or as a place for political communication. And I think that there are reasons to think that artificial intelligence tools could be useful to help track and spot and trace disinformation as much as they are useful for helping to create it. So, I think people really do need to be on guard this year, but I wouldn't assume that 2026 and 2028 are necessarily going to be worse than this year.
Mm-hmm.
I will be out of California interest. I've been working with Politico's California team to develop a coverage area and ballot measures, which has always sort of struck me as a journalist as this grave failing of journalists in our state not to treat this really as a separate branch of government in many respects and approach it the same way we would approach covering the legislature or cover the mayor and do it day in, day out, year in, year out. So we're putting together a team with some dedicated beat reporters who will be covering statewide and local ballot measures and trying to cover them on their own terms and not just as a sort of lesser cousin of candidate campaigns.
Well, of course, here in San Francisco, as you know, we have a hotly contested mayor's race come November and a host of local ballot measures. So I hope that our paths will cross here in San Francisco, Sasha.
Eager to be up there. We were closely monitoring what was on the ballot earlier this month, and I suspect you'll be giving us lots to write about later in the year, too.
Fantastic. And Sasha, where can our listeners buy a copy of your book, The Lie Detectives?
So it's available in a nice, handsome little paperback, in ebook, and audio version. So wherever you buy your books, either in person or online, all the big names, all the little bookstores, hopefully everybody will have it.
And just take a moment to tell us about Columbia Global Reports, the publisher of The Lie Detectives.
Yeah, it's this great little publishing outfit associated with Columbia University that they call them novella-length nonfiction on serious topics of international interest. It's my second book. I read a book with them called Outpatients about medical tourism. It came out 8 years ago, and we've been talking ever since about how to do something about campaign innovation that sort of follows up on my book, The Victory Lab. And a few years ago, we agreed that this sort of question of how campaigns deal with disinformation was ripe, and they've just been wonderful to work with. And they put out about 6 books a year, and the idea is that you can read any one of them on a single flight. So they're this great, as a writer, they're a great length between like a long magazine article and a very, very short book. And I've loved working on them.
And Sasha, how can our listeners follow you? Website, X handle, LinkedIn?
My website URL is my name, which unfortunately is hard to spell, but it's Sasha Eisenberg, SashaIsenberg.com. My X handle is my first initial last name. So S Eisenberg, SISSENBERG.
That's right. And Eisenberg is double S, ISSENBERG.
You got it, Jim. Thank you.
Okay. With a name like Herlihy, I'm always very careful about spelling last names.
And I appreciate it.
Well, Sasha Eisenberg, thank you very much for joining us today.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Jim.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 506. Listen on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, and join our listener audience in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy coming to you from San Francisco.